Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 815.2S0523, certificate number 26780. Mulberry Mania.
We've done shows on this program about berries.
Yeah, the boysenberry.
The boysenberry.
Its origins in Southern California and horticulture.
And we've done shows about the popularization of flora and fauna that are derived from Shakespeare's plays.
Oh yeah, European starling. The starlings became endemic in America after they were introduced by an amateur ornithologist who thought America should have every bird mentioned in Shakespeare.
And we've done shows about a kind of collective mania or hysteria around plant life.
Oh, fern fever.
Fern fever.
Wow. I'm really good at Omnibus.
You are. You're amazing.
This is my category.
We should do it.
Some more.
Let's see. We've done a show about...
We should do a podcast about Omnibus.
Oh, interesting.
Where we just talk about our favorite episodes.
We've never done tulip mania, Dutch tulip mania, have we?
I feel like we were going to, but we did maybe a more interesting speculative bubble, didn't we?
Did we reference it? I feel tulip mania is a thing that's just like a ghost wandering around the halls of this, but I don't remember us doing a show.
We did the onion cornering, but that's a little different. We did do a thing about a speculative bubble. I don't know.
But we today have, as a result of a suggestion from a listener, the great opportunity to do an episode that encompasses all those very omnibus-y qualities. Shakespeare, a mania for a certain kind of plant, and a berry.
So it'll be like you turned on those three entries and synced them up like a Flaming Lips record.
That's right.
And just ran them all at the same time.
Cassette tapes in a parking garage.
The effect you would get would be the same as the effect of listening to this entry, Mulberry Mania.
Although for the purposes of selling advertising, we should probably encourage everyone to go listen to those three episodes, because that's three times the listenership that one episode will gain us.
True. Except those are old ones without ads and probably just us talking about how stuff works.
Yeah. Although maybe by the time futurelings are listening to this show, we will have perfected dynamic advertising in podcasts, and they'll be full of Budweiser ads.
They'll be full of ads for things from your era.
Oh, right. It'll be full of like...
ads for some kind of lichen protein paste that you put in your tanks.
Yeah, or sucker moisturizer for your dried out tentacles.
Flights to Mars. All kinds of stuff.
I'm intrigued by this show because it comes from our Patreon, which enables us to put on the show even in a time when there is no dynamic advertising in podcasts, and most of our ads are still for How Stuff Works shows, which is weird.
Why is that true?
We haven't been on that network in a year and a half. But our Patreon has in its many tiers a level of donation which entitles you to suggest the topic of a show.
And yeah, if you're at the, what is it? The sentient quaking aspen level?
Yeah, the sentient aspen.
Or something like that.
You can suggest a show, and we've done several shows. We have quite a few supporters at the quaking aspen level, and they've suggested many shows. And I think over time, at first, among the Futureling community, there was some resistance or suspicion that Futurelings suggesting shows were going to somehow pollute the natural.
You don't want to let them drive the bus.
Yeah, right. You and I have.
Oh, it's washing bears, by the way, not washing bears.
We have so much, you know, so many wonderful ideas ourselves. Why would we ever need to go do the basically targeted advertising of somebody saying, why don't you do Flamin' Cheetos or whatever? But that hasn't been the case, right? I think Futurelings know what kind of show would be a good omnibus episode. And then they always give us a list of suggestions, and we pick the one that feels the most akin to our natures.
And often it's an interesting nook or cranny. Like, I'm a big fan of omnibus when it's just about some historical thing I discovered accidentally.
Oh, I'm glad you like the show.
And not something. It's good to hear. Huge fan.
Uh-huh. Do you listen to it on road trips?
Listen to it all the time.
Listen to it to go to sleep at night.
But you know, there's a kind of historical podcast which is kind of about the same things that there's been Discovery Channel specials about and show up in mental floss listicles. Uh-huh. And I really like the more organic ones that are just kind of diamonds in the rough, newly discovered weird cultural stuff that hasn't been harvested too many times. And I feel like the listeners are very good at uncovering weird little niches that they're kind of proud of and that they want to put spotlights on for the first time. As opposed to, what's some historical thing that's been on, you know, molasses flood or, you know, something that's already been on a lot of TV and.
I've never heard of the molasses flood.
Oh, we should do it then.
Yeah, we should jettison this episode.
Let's do it right now. Okay. All right. There's a molasses flood.
Right. Right. How did all the molasses get into one location?
I think it was being stored.
Okay.
But there was a hole, a molasses hole.
In the bucket?
Yes, in the giant molasses bucket.
Oh, dear Liza.
Maybe there's a molasses pipeline of some kind? I'm not sure.
Well, we have to do a little more research before we do the molasses flood, it sounds like. But yeah, I agree. There are, one of the challenges of doing this kind of show is that there are a lot of podcasters who thought up the idea of
two people yammering on about some historical thing they don't really know that much about.
Yeah, it's a fairly common within a narrow genre of. I mean, most podcasts are about sports and true crime, but within the history styles, and so we're always trying to find things that other people wouldn't have found. I think they're also out there trying to find things we haven't found.
Added value? No, they don't care.
But we're smart.
We want to get off the beaten path.
Right?
They're just like dur molasses flood.
Herpa derp. Didn't you see this thing I read in Wired? But we are fortunate as the proprietors to have within the Futurelings community a lot of very interesting, informed, eccentric people from around the globe. We get letters from them all the time, some of them very hard to read because they're written in Latin or in Aspenian.
Cuneiform.
but we hear from people all the time and you know, we're delighted at how at what a diverse audience we have, and it's a pleasure to serve you, Futurelings. Thanks for tuning in. This has been Omnibus.
And that concludes Mulberry Mania. I thought it'd be more about mulberries.
Well, actually, here's the addenda. Here, during the outro, I'll do the episode.
Okay.
Futurelings from our vantage point in your distant past. But today, we're doing a show that was pitched to us by an omnibus listener who goes by the handle Robert K.S. Now, Ken, you have some experience, or you have some history with Robert K.S.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure I've even met Robert. He's big in the online Jeopardy community. He's a fan, former contestant on the show, but more to the point, I think he's one of the founders and leading lights of the J Archive, which is an unofficial online archive of hundreds of thousands of Jeopardy clues, something that fans of the show, and especially people training to be contestants on the show, have always wanted access to and did not exist when I was first on the show in 2004. But I think Robert is one of the pioneering workers in this genre of archiving old Jeopardy boards.
Now, let me just ask, does this mean that someone has manually inputted all these questions and answers throughout? Do they sit and watch old Jeopardies and furiously type as Alex points to the big board? And
yeah, they've been doing it in real time ever since the site started around, I don't know, 2006 or seven, maybe.
Wow.
A little earlier, but they are also archiving old games as they turn up on creaky old VHS tapes or whatever. Jeopardy's not in reruns.
So when you say the online Jeopardy community, my mind it's just a kaleidoscope of ideas that pop into my head. But tell me more about the online Jeopardy community. Is it authorized by the Jeopardy Enterprise?
No, that's the thing about, I mean, Jeopardy does have a website and whatnot, but there's a bunch of...
I bet it's great.
There's a bunch of...
Does it have some 8-bit animation?
It's pretty good.
Is it?
I'll go there right now. Jeopardy.com. What's going on there today? It's showing all the upcoming guest hosts on the show. It's a solid site.
So while we were recording this show, Futurelings in Your Distant Past, the Jeopardy program was still featuring guest hosts. But when this show airs, that there may be there may have been some new news. Is that right?
The guest hosts will still be running. I don't know when they're going to announce.
When this show airs, the guest hosts will still be running.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Good. So nobody in the future knows anything more than we do.
In the distant future, people know whether or not Anderson Cooper ended up hosting Jeopardy. For
He's who teams. I'm rooting for.
We all love Anderson.
Yeah.
Silver Fox.
Although Katie Couric, you know, warms the cockles of my heart.
Very chipper.
Yeah, she's chipper.
She's a cockle warmer. But in addition to the Jeopardy official site. There's a bunch of fan fora, including probably most prominently the J Archive, which is, you know, because it has hundreds of thousands of past clues, it's a valuable resource for people who want to get better at the show.
Oh, I see.
So it's a site that will routinely be mined by people who are like, well, you know, I want to go on Jeopardy, but I don't know opera that much. So let me just see
what they've asked.
Yeah. Let me see. Dozens and dozens of opera categories from years past, and you know, I'll make flashcards.
How much Jeopardy slash fic is there?
I don't know if I have ever seen.
Come on,
there's just not a lot of free time in the show. We know everything that's going on. I mean, anything that doesn't we don't see happen during a commercial.
But it's all in the back. It's all in the dressing rooms, right?
Oh, I think you mean before and after the game.
Yeah, right. Like after the game, it's like good job.
It's a real swinging party back there.
Somebody grabs somebody else, and there's lots of kissing.
I used to make that joke about the college tournament that it would be like, you know, they're always talking about how horny the Olympic Village is.
Yeah,
you know, you like the Olympic Village is just nonstop sexcapades for the whole. You think the Olympics are, you know, a high-minded path to world peace.
Just but like really, they were in ancient Greece.
But really, it's just young, fit people hopping all over each other, just like they were in ancient Greece.
Well, the thing about the Olympics is when you are done with your, I mean, it's all these big flashy moments. You go do your thing and then you're done. But the Olympics linger on and you're there in the Olympic Village just walking around. And you're
still full of adrenaline.
Yeah. Tight swimsuits.
Wearing skimpy stuff.
Yeah.
It's no wonder that people get up to no good.
But I would think wouldn't get into a sexcapade before your event. Right, because it would sap your precious bodily fluids.
That's what they say.
Yeah,
I remember asking a college tournament person if that went on at the hotel. Apparently, a little different.
Oh, because they're nerds.
I don't know. Well, that doesn't stop the band people.
That's true. It's true.
But I don't know. Maybe they're just I don't know.
Hmm.
Maybe they really are too high minded.
Yeah.
For them, it's all about.
I could see that.
The answers and questions.
Trying to picture anything sexy happening within the Jeopardy verse. It's hard for me to do, frankly.
You don't find Jeopardy sexy on a nightly basis like I do?
sexy. Yeah. Okay. No, now that I'm putting it together, I do. Yeah.
Do you think the set should have like maybe more bean bags and throw pillows?
The thing is, there are a lot of dark corners in the Jeopardy studio, right? I mean, all that stuff under the bandstand, what's happening under there and in the back? I mean, you guys kept parading in and out, and there are a lot of shadowy corners.
And that's what they're for.
I bet you there are people getting it on.
Probably all the time.
Well, so our correspondent today, our supporter, our futureling friend, Robert K.S., because he is a donor at the Washing Bear level, he sent in 4 suggestions. And this happens all the time. We get suggestions from listeners all the time. And generally, people send in a suggestion and it's accompanied by just a very brief explanatory short paragraph trying to explain why it would be an interesting topic. Often they will target a suggestion to one of the two of us.
This would be a good John show because it's about some Alaskan mountain climber.
Yeah, it's about airplanes and, you know, it would help if he had walked across Europe, which he never seems to mention.
Does that ever show up in job listings? Walking across Europe a plus.
Or it's like, hey, this is an esoteric math question that, you know, or like a sports thing that neither one of you understand. Ken would be perfect for this.
Yeah, and they often have a pretty good sense of the omnibus aesthetic. Rarely are we like, do you ever listen to the show?
Yeah. But this this suggestion or this list of 4 suggestions came with extensive notes. And we've seen this before, too.
Well, Robert is a Jeopardy champion.
He's a Jeopardy champion, and after I did a little research on Robert, he works in patent law, and he's a prominent.
That's like my own family is full of IP lawyers.
Yeah, he's a prominent Midwesterner. You know, the Midwest is sparsely populated, so it doesn't take much to be like the biggest guy in Ohio, if you know what I'm saying. I mean, who lives in Ohio?
If you're not going to ride down the road to see your neighbors, you might just stay home and go down Wikipedia rabbit holes all day.
That's right. If you're not going to, put 2 horses on your buggy and head over to Indiana to get some new overalls. But so Robert sent us these suggestions and, his suggestions really stuck out to us.
Are you going to go through the ones that you did not select?
Well, should I do? Yeah, I'll do. Well, because
maybe there's briefly.
There's another one that appeals to me. My sister, I just picked my sister up at the airport last night, and she started talking about, she just made a trip to Florida, and she said, oh, there was a bull mastiff puppy where I was staying. And I said, you know, hilariously, I was just reading about the old English mastiff as I was waiting in the parking lot to pick you up at the airport. And she said, for what? And I said, because it was suggested to me as an omnibus topic. And so I started, and she's a fan of dogs. I started regaling her with facts about the old English mastiff. And she was very excited and thought that for sure today that I would be doing our episode today on the mastiff.
She got a little personalized omnibus there in the car.
She did. I gave her the full story of the mastiff, and there's much to rejoice in about the breed of the mastiff. It's not one of these breeds that's a result of like sort of orchid breeding dog people of the 19th century who took some poor 2 dogs and combined them in a freakish science experiment to make the toy Chihuahua or whatever it is.
Teacup Schnauzer.
Yeah, a lot of the dog breeds are fairly recent inventions, and the Mastiff turns out to be an ancient dog, older than humans. It used to have wings. It lived in the trees.
It ate mastodon meat,
and it always looked like a mastiff except with wings until it evolved the wings away. It's older than ferns, the mastiff.
I wish we hadn't evolved the ferns away or the wings away.
Well, I know. Well, except that the largest mastiff weighed something like 350 pounds. So would you like a winged 350-pound mastiff community?
Swooping down on you?
Yeah, if they just sort of lived around here and it was a risk every time you went out?
You could put like a bell on them or something, the way they do for cats. Mm.
Like a bell, like a Swedish cow?
Like a Liberty Bell. Dong, dong.
But so the four suggestions, and Robert very curiously suggested a topic and then with a slash added an adjacent kind of contextualizing topic to each of his topics. So for instance, the book Symbolism in Greek Mythology by Paul Dial, or yeah, Dial.
Okay, some classic mythology text, I guess.
A classic mythology text, but the real topic is the sort of autodidactic philosophy of Paul Dial, who, you know, it was a contemporary of, or maybe a slightly later contemporary of Freud and Jung, and who developed kind of his own, and he has one of these wonderful life stories, developed a sort of his own experiential psychology and ultimately became kind of a cult figure within French-German psychological communities.
But he will not be appearing on today's Omnibus.
Not except as this reference, no.
Adios, Paul Dial.
And Symbolism in Greek Mythology was his book where he kind of psychoanalyzed Greek gods. And I happen to be right now reading Metamorphoses by Ovid as part of my book club. And so I was very curious about his writings, but I felt like I couldn't do the episode justice until I had either read his text or finished Ovid.
It seems like Robert is really maybe he's spying on you. Like he knows what you and your sister wants to talk about at the airport. He knows what your book club is reading.
Yep. It's curious because in his proposals here, he did not specify who he intended these topics to, you know, who he intended them for. But within his text, he does seem several times to be talking to me. And as a Jeopardy fan person, I would assume he would not care about me at all and want to talk to you and have you do reinforce his.
Maybe he's bored of Jeopardy people. Maybe he hangs out with Jeopardy people all the time.
I certainly do. I certainly am.
You're like the antidote to that.
The antidote!
John, the antidote, Roderick.
So the Old English Mastiff was another of his suggestions. And then this one does seem more like a Ken episode. The Honeywell versus Sperry, Honeywell versus Sperry Rand, which was a lawsuit about the ENIAC computer and how it, and the copyrights.
Caught me in the middle of doing the hokey pokey, so I'm all turned around. Hope you're enjoying your day too.
You used the C word.
I hope that our listeners were able to hear that.
Why is she doing the hokey pokey?
I don't know. Mark Miles, if you can amplify Alexa for that little burst, it'd be curious. I'd be curious to hear any futurelings that know what the hell she's
talking
about.
Does it humanize Alexa to you that she talks about different children's dances she's doing?
No.
It doesn't help me.
No.
That doesn't make her seem more reliable to me.
It enrages me just as much as when ATMs try and talk to me like, hi, friend, how are you today? What can I like to do you for? Yeah. But Honeywell versus Sperry Rand and the Brainiac culture, I guess it remains in dispute, the results of this lawsuit, because what the lawsuit concluded was that the copyrights on ENIAC technology,
maybe patents, probably,
or patents, right? The patents of, and I guess it's ENIAC, not ENIAC.
I don't know how to say it.
Yeah, the patents on ENIAC were basically invalidated, and a lot of the computer science became sort of public domain.
You got away with one.
I did.
She made a little peep when you said the C word, but.
Public domain well before when those patents would have expired. Ooh. So the patents would have extended into the early 80s, but because they were invalidated in this court opinion in the 60s, it sort of opened the floodgates to the personal computer revolution.
And again, this is a legal battle that will not be appearing in this entry.
This is not an entry about that. No. The first suggestion, Robert's first suggestion, was the Multicaulis Mania / Shakespeare's Mulberry.
Shakespeare's Mulberry.
And Shakespeare's Mulberry is, as you'll see in the episode, this is where Robert has perhaps, he's perhaps / added a whole separate topic, because Mulberry Mania is an omnibus episode on its own.
But he also thinks we need to get into what, Shakespeare?
Well, because Mulberry's, there is a Shakespearean connection. Mulberry's appear in Shakespeare, and then Mulberry's became part of the Shakespeare story in life.
Mm. So Robert has a beautiful and active mind, and he sees connections spiraling outward.
That's right.
And in fact, he sent those all to us.
Sent them all to us. But what separates Robert's suggestions from any other we've ever received?
Length.
Is length. And also, Robert is a completionist and clearly a legal scholar, or he has a legal mind. And Robert, in his suggestions, basically wrote four complete magazine articles where he did extensive research, and the magazine articles themselves more or less stand on their own.
Maybe Robert should have a podcast. It seems like he's missing a trick. He is now paying us to make him do research for us for free.
And I wonder whether maybe Robert doesn't have a melodious voice, or maybe...
That has never stopped me.
Well, no, your voice gets more melodious all the time.
No, it does not.
You know what we should do? We should start you smoking.
That's really what I need.
You know, if you smoked just a little bit.
What if, you know how they use auto-tune for people who can't sing? Can't they just make everyone into a newsreader now with a little digital help? Like why couldn't Mark Miles make me sound like, make me sound like Burl Ives?
Anderson Cooper. Mark Miles, I would like to suggest that for the next little bit, you put a
booming stentorian voice.
Yeah, if you can just put a filter on Ken that basically makes him sound like Foster Brooks.
Is that a thing? Hit the Foster Brooks button?
Well, let's see if Mark Miles can do it. He's an audio engineer. Mark Miles, the third Beatle of the Omnibus program. So here we are at what we could generously call the beginning of the show, top of the show here. And I was, faced with this extensive research that Robert had done, and I felt somewhat guilty at being, I guess, able to not do any research for this show and just read Robert's magazine article.
What a parasite you are.
Well, yeah, right. But, as you say,
there's plenty of shows where people just read notes about stuff they don't know about.
Sure, right. Well, and so I thought I would experiment with that today. And what's strange is that Mulberry Mania was already something that I had been considering as an omnibus topic.
You knew about mulberries and their respective mania?
Well, I got so jealous when you did Boysenberries, and it was a very popular episode, and I was like, why does he corner the market on berries here? And then I did Fern Fever, which, I thought was a pretty successful show.
Love Fern Fever.
But
there was Fern Fever Fever when it came out, do you remember?
Yeah, Fern Fever Fever.
Fern Fever Fever swept the country.
Your shows are very popular. I feel like maybe this isn't clear to futurelings, but I'm in desperately locked in a competition to the death with you over whose shows get more likes.
Oh, is that true?
No, not at all. I'm not on Facebook, so I don't see it.
I would argue that the secret sauce of my shows is you interrupting and vice versa.
Right.
So really it might be a referendum on which of us has worse shows.
You're barely interrupting on this show.
Well, I don't want to interrupt Robert.
Oh, I see.
He's paying for the privilege.
Sure, it's
it would be rude.
Sure, it's respect, right? Anyway, so what I'm going to do.
Also, you haven't said anything yet.
Oh, true.
Still waiting for the mulberries and the mania.
What I'm going to do today, it's a different kind of show. I'm just going to read Robert's email And then, Ken, as we go down, if you have any questions, you can ask, and then I'll turn to my own research that I'd already done about mulberries.
Okay. So you're a mulberry expert at this point.
Well,
you're just using Robert's notes for structure.
Perhaps not an expert, but Robert's notes are going to, you know, I'm going to fill in if there are, and honestly, he really did quite a bit of work here. So it's going to be interesting to see if you even can formulate a question that Robert hasn't covered.
What if we call them Robert's Rules of Order?
Let's call these Robert's Rules of Order. And he has conveniently sort of, he's prefaced each thought with a single dash. Now, what's the copywriter take on that?
It's like an email equivalent of a bullet point.
Yeah.
He also has a lengthy bibliography. I don't know if you saw.
Well, that's the other thing. He put so many links at the bottom of his essay.
This is how you became an expert on mulberry.
We should just put this up on the site. All of his, if you'd want to read all these other like source texts,
because this is the only omnibus that will ever have any kind of academic rigor, because it was not
right.
You and I working.
Right.
Got it.
But the work that I've done here is I've taken his email and I've put it in 18-point tights so I can read it, and I've put paragraph breaks wherever he had a dash.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've done quite a bit of.
I don't use the word hero lightly, John, but that's fantastic.
Okay, so we're going to get a little background. We're going to get a little bit of Robert's biography sprinkled in here. We're going to get to know Robert a little bit better too.
This is very unusual, even for a request. A request omnibus entry.
Well, I feel like in the future, if you want to frame your request in the form of writing like a very long magazine article about the topic, you know, Ken or I may. This may be a very popular show. Robert may end up being a cult figure here in the program. Although maybe not.
There could be statues of him in the future alongside us.
Yeah, people are like, okay, all right, John, you know.
Except in his statue, he's actually researching something.
Yeah, right. He's like...
And you and I are talking with our butts like Ace Ventura.
He's the real hero. Okay, here we go. Now, imagine this in Robert's voice. Maybe I should do this in a British accent to distinguish Robert from, you know, people in Ohio.
Does it bother you that he's not British?
Well, people in Ohio have a distinctive accent.
Which you can do. Hey, Mark Miles, why don't you turn on the... Guy from Ohio filter when John talks, we can hear with pinpoint accuracy what an Ohioan sounds like.
Yeah, I'm gonna say do the Arnon. Do the Arnon out.
Do they say Washington? That's more of a Missouri thing.
I think they say Washington. Washington? Used to. I think they say. Do they say roof? I think they say roof.
Sometimes I say roof if I'm in the mood.
They definitely say pop
instead of soda.
Some of them do.
Like it.
Anyway, here he goes. Where I live in Northeast Ohio, mulberries are classed by dour arborists as weed trees.
Ooh.
So he's already slammed a bunch of arborists.
For their narrow-minded view of tree value.
Yeah, they're not like hilarious arborists. They're dour and circumspect. But now, speaking of mulberries, they are ubiquitous in urban and rural places. Ubiquitous. Proliferated by bird droppings and lodging themselves in fence rows.
I want to look at a mulberry tree and see if I actually will recognize one.
So there are a lot of different varieties of mulberry, and a lot of mulberries themselves look like really hilariously long blackberries.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing.
Some of them are like blackberries as long as human fingers.
It looks like you're taking a picture of a blackberry with your panorama mode, but then your hand slipped or something.
Yeah.
Or the berry moved.
It's a hilariously long mulberry.
I don't know if Seattle has mulberry trees, urban mulberry trees. There's those gross chokecherry things.
I have not seen native mulberries here in Seattle. And if people have planted them as fruit varieties, I haven't seen those either. I think I would be, if I saw a mulberry, I would race to it.
Maybe the climate doesn't lend themselves to mulberries here.
There are mulberries all around the United States, as we'll see.
Are they native?
Well, there's
I don't
one.
Jump ahead.
So the red mulberry is native. The other varieties, the white and black, there are many, many mulberries, but a lot of them are imported. And we'll see why soon. Again, to Robert. Mulberries, the fruit, can be very tasty, but they're hard to find in stores because they don't keep more than about a day, and the season is relatively short.
Hmm.
And as we'll see, mulberries as a culinary item. Well, as a crop, were not planted for their fruit.
Wow.
Yeah, we'll see that in a second.
Actually, I know this. I'm the guy on the podcast pretending to be surprised.
Yeah, you're like, say what?
Wait, what?
No.
Tell me more.
I know.
I know what mulberries are for.
Also, their flavor doesn't seem to be well distillable, so you don't find mulberry-flavored foods.
That's what I was going to say. There's no mulberry jam or whatever.
Right, because kind of the way that the boysenberry was the result of trying to make a fruit that was stable, shelf-stable, distillable. No, it wasn't the product of it, but it was that was a component in the show.
Sure.
Component of the story.
I don't remember. It ended at Disneyland.
That's right. It was a great show. And I, and like all our shows, I remember every word we said. But mulberries are not well distillable.
It's kind of like I've always been complaining about salmon berries, where they have a mild taste, which is just fine for walking in the woods.
Yes.
But nobody ever thought, let's have some salmonberry flavored candy. Let's put salmonberry syrup on our hotcakes. Said no one ever.
Well, and there are, by some reports, mulberries are so fragile that just plucking one off the tree, the fruit kind of explodes and your hands are drenched in mulberry juice. Like you can't even really pick them to take them home. But you can, and people use them to flavor ice cream. It's just it, by the time you would get into a commercial process, the fruit doesn't survive. Sometimes you can find mulberry wine or mulberry tea, but generally mulberries are not farmed, paren for their fruit.
Right.
And, their consumption tends to be limited to opportunistic foraging.
That's my favorite kind of foraging.
Now you'll notice, even now at second paragraph that Robert has a very distinctive prose style. He's casual. He's smart. His writing is good.
This is very unusually, eloquent for an omnibus entry, actually.
Well, thank you.
I like the fact that we have complete sentences and dour arborists.
Yeah, I'm getting to practice my dramatic interp. A new paragraph. Depending on the tree species, the fruits range. Now, here's a little bit of a typo. He says the fruits range color, but of course the fruits range in color.
It's an informal email. He didn't know you were going to be doing a dramatic monologue.
Did he not?
He should have been ready.
Yeah.
Anytime you email us, this could happen.
So from now on, I'm not gonna paren sick any of these
that's good.
Typos. I'm just gonna fill it in.
You're punching down.
Yeah. Depending on the tree species, the fruits range in color, size, and fruit flesh density, which I like to think I have flesh density. I feel like you could measure my flesh density.
I have ranged in flesh density over the course of my life.
Some mulberries are a deep dark purple. Others are pink.
I'm picturing purple for sure.
Others, wait for it, are bright white.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Fruit color cannot be. Yeah, fruit color.
Oh, yeah.
This is what's really crazy.
You don't really see a white berry that often. It's got little black spots. It looks like a kiwi or something.
How would you think a white mulberry would taste compared to like a purple mulberry?
You would assume it would be less intense.
Right.
These would be the wan vampiric ones.
But they're kind of gorgeous. A white mulberry is kind of a gorgeous fruit.
It looks like it's made of rice.
And can you imagine like sitting down to a royal feast and a big platter of white mulberries came out?
Very fancy.
Oh, that would be so fancy. This is what's very interesting. Fruit color cannot be used, however, to reliably identify tree species because the Asian native Morus alba, or white mulberry, can produce purple fruit.
Wait, what?
And the fruit of the North American native Morus rubra, or red mulberry, starts out as white.
So it might be different. It's a different times in its life cycle, or maybe it's soil conditions like the hydrangea can affect the fruit.
Or if, you know, like the way that you're famous for insulting snakes, if you're out insulting mulberry trees, maybe their peak makes them redden in color in rage. And if you neglect them, maybe if you turn a cold shoulder to them, they turned white.
I hope they curse you.
With embarrassment. I
hope they curse you back. They are very tall. They really are. They are the tallest fruit.
Well, yeah. And the bushes get very tall when they mature. So, Robert, again, I'm now pretty sure, based on descriptions available online, that the single tree I'm most fond of, and which produces deep purple fruit, is not a native red mulberry, as I had first assumed from the fruit color, but a white mulberry, or maybe a red-white hybrid. And the trees do hybridize, and in some, and this is now, I'm speaking now, not Robert.
I can tell.
Oh, thank you.
I could tell where it shifted.
Well, so I'm wondering whether I should speak in italics or what? Do I give him an accent?
Say close quote. Or maybe you can do like a Ken Burns documentary and say, Robert K.S.
How did white mulberries the... I may do that. Mulberries, the Native American red mulberry bush is now sort of endangered, and in fact... regarded as endangered in many places because
of the new arrivals.
Because the new arrivals have cross-pollinated with them, and the pure red mulberry strain is now hard to find.
We've also done a show about endangered northeastern trees.
We have.
Was it Dutch elm disease or chestnuts or something?
Dutch elm disease, and also didn't we do something about how there's no more corn and no more apples? Or did we just talk about that in our private lives? All the apples are all
do,
the.
Do you think the show was called "There's No More Corn and No More Apples"?
There's no more corn and no more apples. We Johnny Appleseed. We were talking
That's
about.
That's true. There are some of those cultivars just don't exist anymore.
Yeah. How did the white mulberries, the Chinese plants whose leaves are the preferred diet of silkworms, get to Northeast Ohio? That's not how Robert actually talks.
He's Shelby Foote. Isn't there some famous movie character that was just, I think it's Daniel Craig in Knives Out is doing an impression of Shelby Foote from the Civil War.
Oh.
That's where he got his.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
His honey-baked accent.
English colonists brought the trees to America in the early 17th century. And it,
They brought some British mulberries.
Well, so. And I don't think that we talk about this. I don't think Robert talks about this, but actually King James, there's a whole English history of trying to cultivate mulberries for this reason that we're about to,
we're dancing all around dramatically.
But mulberry trees arrived very early in Jamestown, as an attempt to cultivate a silk production industry in the Americas.
Sericulture.
And so sericulture is the whole process of growing mulberries to feed silkworms to produce the cocoons that from whence we derive silk.
Because the Chinese worms that produce silk only will thrive in mulberry trees.
White mulberries specifically. And what the pupa eat, what the caterpillars eat, is not the mulberry fruit that looks like a giant white blackberry finger, but in fact the leaves of the mulberry. And so the bushes and this as I think probably most futurelings know, for many thousands of years, the Chinese kept this secret, this sericultural cycle, a state secret. It was the sericultural cycle was a state secret.
It's a very alliterative tactic.
Yeah, and I'm great at saying S's because of my 11 missing teeth.
They didn't want word getting out to Japan or India as to how one did this.
Right, because
then they could keep selling them silk at outrageously high prices.
Silk was an incredible commodity. I mean, it was like the market of silk in the not like ancient world, but yeah, would you say ancient world? I guess ancient is the world.
Sure.
Silk was one of the things that opened up the world. The Silk Road, famously, from Turkey to China. And if you could grow silk everywhere, why would you take a camel train to China? I mean, I ask this question of you a lot.
I'm reading right now a PETA document arguing that the current silk industry is very hard on the silkworms. They have to die once they've made their little cocoons.
Well, and that has always been true.
Often in cruel ways.
So PETA is not wrong. The silkworm as it metamorphosizes into a moth, it has to die along the way. It has to die before it comes out, because
that would ruin the silk.
Yeah, as it chews its way out of its cocoon, it chews through the fibers, and part of
you'd have holes in your tie.
Yeah, the way that you take silk from a cocoon, mm-hmm, is that you actually unwind it. It's a continuous thread, or rather, long sections of continuous thread that you can kind of you can spool together. But you need to this is the real difficulty in producing silk as a industrial product, is that unwinding a cocoon is extremely labor intensive.
Sounds like a hassle. I can't get my earbuds untangled.
It's really a hassle, and also it is a skill. You can't just do it. If I gave you
a cocoon
and said unwind this, you would almost certainly ruin it. And I don't. And that's not a slur. I'm not. I don't say that about you in particular. In particular, because I couldn't do it either, Ken.
We need to have the long, graceful fingers of the sericulturist.
Well, so the way that you produce silk from a cocoon is that once the worm has spun its cocoon and inhabits it and is inside transforming, you harvest the cocoon, worm inside, and then you put them in a pot and boil them.
Oh, well, that's not nice.
It's not nice. And it kills the worm. And then there's an outside, a kind of, you know, a crust to the outside. It's also like a fibrous husk.
On the outside of the cocoon.
On the outside of the cocoon.
It's not silk.
It's not silk. Okay. Although it is used, even now, used to stuff pillows. I mean, it's a kind of soft byproduct of silk production. And it can be used for a lot of things. So you boil the cocoon, the husk, you take off, and then
to stuff pillows,
and then there's a little spooler, and this process is called reeling. And you sit and reel in the out of the pot of boiling water, which has to be exactly the right temperature to kind of loosen the strands. You reel in the silk, but to do it properly, the silk cannot, the thread of silk cannot line up parallel to itself as you reel it on. What would happen if it did? Well, it becomes gummy and sticks together, and it doesn't dry, maintaining its kind of super fine, clean nature. And so the proper way to do it as you reel it is to reel it onto the spool at an angle, and then on the way back cross angle,
right?
So that every spool of silk, and I think if you've ever seen a spool of silk, it is reeled on this way. It's a cross hatch
back and forth and right back and forth.
So that every time the strand goes over itself, it's at an angle.
Got it.
And it doesn't allow it to kind of gum up. And this...
You said I couldn't do it, but I think now you've walked me through it, and I bet I'd be pretty good.
Well, I think you and I would be better knowing that than if we had just sort of started spooling it around our thumb. But it's an incredibly strong fiber, but also incredibly... it came out of a worm's butt. It's not...
So what does that mean? It's stinky?
No, but it's a thing that, yeah, I think there are 500 ways to mess it up and only one way to do it right. And this will play out in our story. Here we go. How did white mulberries, the Chinese plant whose leaves are the preferred diet of silkworms, get to Northeast Ohio?
Yeah, I've often wondered.
English colonists brought the trees to America in the early 17th century. In 1624, the legislature of Virginia required every male resident to plant at least 4 white mulberry trees.
That's very early.
To promote a North American silk industry. Now, this is before before there's a mass tobacco industry, before there's a cotton industry of any kind. One of the very first, and it's part of the mandate of Virginia.
I wondered if they thought it was favorable to silk conditions in a way that Europe was not. Because I don't know any stories of European powers mandating mulberry planting back home, or did they do that too?
So this was part of, silk was one of the fine goods, one of the finest goods, along with frankincense and myrrh and gold and
Nutella.
And it will be tobacco.
Yeah.
And then later cotton. But it's a fine good, a processed good, that there's, as there is increasingly a global trade, there's also a sense of monopoly and a feeling that we're now, silk is such a prized commodity and we're dependent on a Chinese silk. And so we need to find a way to make silk a cash crop elsewhere so that we can control the market. It's the usual English capitalism trying to figure out a way that they can be not dependent. So there's not a silk gap.
You don't want a silk gap.
You don't want a silk gap. And so trying to figure out
today we're fine with everything we own being manufactured in China.
Absolutely. It's the preferred way because it's easier to ship raw materials to China on a giant boat, steaming the whole way, just spewing cold ash into the sky, have them process it and steam it all the way back and truck it to your home in Northeast Ohio.
To my dollar store.
Than it is to just make it there. But we'll see that this was true hundreds of years ago. In the 1820s and 1830s, now we're jumping ahead, a sericulture craze exploded out of Connecticut, aided by sericulture promoting government subsidies.
Wait, when is this? Early 19th century?
Early 19th century. So I'll fill in.
Suddenly Connecticut is trying to get a silk industry going.
I'll fill in some of the gaps here.
Okay.
Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries in the United States, there was a lot of interest in the idea that we could grow silk, that we could process silk here in the United States, and that this would be a thing that sort of that it was a crop where the United States in particular could become, or rather the Americas, could become the new center of silk production to rival China, to produce a kind of through, America and English mills, because silk was not just then a favored garment, but also was, used in a lot of applications. And, sort of like whale oil, it was a thing that in the United States was promoted as a way of becoming a global power.
Do you think some of this is just cultural after effect of, the first people who came to these shores accidentally thinking they were in China or India or whatever? Like this is the place we used to think is China. And then it turned out it wasn't, but they could still grow a silk.
We could still grow silk.
If they wanted.
If you think about this period, right, where, European a lot, this is a big part of the motivation of colonizing the, taking sugar and making a plantation, moving, potato production and tobacco production and pineapples. And
I mean, in the case of sugar and coffee and pineapple, that's because your native country doesn't have the weather for it.
Right.
Would that be true of mulberries too?
Well, mulberries grow in Southern Europe, and they were being cultivated in Southern Europe, and Turkey and so forth. But that's also like an area that the UK didn't have complete control over, and they're trying this out in colonial territories all across the world. But what was interesting about it was that it could be a sort of family farm enterprise. You didn't need to industrialize this across, you didn't need a 10,000 acre farm to do it. You could grow 50 mulberry trees or bushes on your, you know, on part of your farm. And it was promoted as a family enterprise that, that the farmer could grow the bushes and then the women could cultivate the moths and propagate them and then harvest the cocoon.
Thread, yeah.
And then this would be an activity that the women and children with their tiny little hands. And in much of the literature around this, invalid people, your old aunt, you know, someone that couldn't work on the farm, you could, someone in your family, you could put them to work sitting and doing this meticulous work of unspooling and reeling the silk.
They'd be twiddling with some kind of thread anyway.
And like, this,
they'd be doing needlepoint anyway. Why not put them to work?
So it wasn't like sugar or coffee where you had to go in and
big labor,
you know,
force,
yeah, and slam a bunch of this stuff
forests,
into the jungle.
Right.
This was, and it had a very, like Puritan and kind of Christian association, because there, this could be a noble seeming, you know, there, it wasn't, silk production wasn't like coffee or sugar. It's not a commodity that, that brings ruin, right? There's no, you know, coffee.
This is early sustainability.
Yeah. Coffee tends to make you sit around in a coffee shop and discuss, you know, socialism.
I want free range, single source silk.
This is just, all this produces is a, this beautiful and valuable silk thread. And so from throughout the colonial period, there were multiple attempts to establish a silk production industry in the United States. In 1734, the Colonial Assembly of in Connecticut passed a whole raft of incentives to encourage farmers to grow mulberries to propagate silk. And unfortunately, silkworms do not prefer the leaf of the red mulberry. And so,
did we know this then? Did Connecticut know this?
Connecticut didn't really know it. Mm. And it took a while of experimenting with, you know, bringing silkworms in to realize that silkworms really prefer the soft, delicate leaf of the white mulberry, the Asian mulberry.
I have kids like that too. They should eat what they're given.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Here's what's for dinner. Red mulberry. Sorry.
Sorry.
Eat up.
Crunch, 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 crunch.
I guess you just get worse cocoons.
In the 1750s, there was an American horticulturist. Now, this is me. I'm just filling in here. An American horticulturist by the name of Nathaniel Aspinwall, who had a mulberry nursery on Long Island, and he started distributing mulberry bushes as a component of this, at this sort of industry, this attempt to establish an American industry that was virtuous and was a kind of bedroom, like
family business.
But the real instigator was Ezra Stiles, the president of Yale University.
Okay.
Who,
stay in your lane, Ezra Stiles.
Who in the 1760s decided that American silk and mulberry cultivation was his, this was his crusade. And he wrote to all his fellow ministers, because as you know, at that time, Yale, like all American universities, was a religious institution.
I assumed he was a minister because his name was Ezra.
Ezra, exactly. Who's going to name your kid Ezra if not someone who intends your child to be a minister and ultimately a president of a university?
Sure.
Ezra wrote to all the ministers in his denomination and said, you should begin cultivating mulberries. And having, you know, after 3 years of growing mulberry bushes, you should give 1/4 of your mulberries to your parishioners free of charge to lift up the race, you know, like give, yeah, like
What a gift to your town.
Yeah, go forth and prosper. And then you continue to cultivate the other three quarters.
It's like Amway.
It's like Amway, except mulberry bushes. And Styles was just a fanatic about them and about, you know, promoting them as a new American industry. He kept a journal, a kind of now renowned journal of mulberry cultivation from the 1760s all the way to the 1790s. And mulberries, you know, George Washington grew mulberries. Mulberries lined the lane at Monticello. Mm. And by 1825, mulberries were a major crop in the state of Connecticut. They were throughout the Americas, or through the United States, or the nascent United States, and then the United States.
Was it working? Were they getting silk out of it, or were the trees just propagating without much economic success?
Well, they were getting silk, but the problem was that they, and by they I mean we Americans, did not.
Thank you for taking responsibility.
Did not successfully perfect the reeling. And what we found was the small hands of the children did not make it.
Our children are small, but they're dumb. That's still the Connecticut state motto to this day.
That's right. Our children are small, but dumb. And I think what was discovered was that farm wives had a lot of other work to do and didn't have all day to sit patiently reeling silk threads out of a pot of hot water. And however large our population of disabled people was at the time, the number of people whose disabilities allowed them still to sit all day in front of a pot of hot water reeling silk, it was not sufficient to drive an entire industry.
So it does not work as a cottage industry.
So what happened was we were reeling a lot of low quality silk.
Just like American cheese is not as good as cheese, American silk is not as good as silk.
So the first garment mill in the United States was in Mansfield, Connecticut. It was established in 1810. And when it came time to produce silk garments, the Mansfield mill imported silk from Southern Europe and Asia, even though in Connecticut at the time, there was this boom of silk production. And we were producing silk. It was low quality. So now we'll go back to Robert. In the 1820s and 1830s, a sericulture craze exploded out of Connecticut, aided by sericulture promoting government subsidies. Promise of instant riches spread across the eastern states, then west to Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, and Illinois.
So it's like a get-rich-quick thing.
It's a get-rich-quick scheme.
The promise of the frontier.
All you needed were some mulberry trees and some silkworm seeds, and you could be a silkinaire. That's a sort of a... He's pandering to you.
That's a Robert neologism?
Yeah, I think so. Millions of white mulberry trees were planted in North America in the span of a decade.
Maybe mullionaire would have been funnier. I'm just spitballing.
You know, you and Robert can do this on a separate
That's
thread.
True. We don't have to do this on the show.
Yeah. Email him tonight. But one amateur sericulturalist after another fell victim to rookie mistakes and went bankrupt. As a typical example, Phineas Powers was a New Yorker who in 1836 cleared land in the northeast Ohio county of Lorain to plant 20,000 white mulberry trees.
Whoa.
His enterprise fared well his first year in operation, but his silkworm stock was ravaged by disease. A few decades later, Louis Pasteur devoted himself to solving silkworm diseases.
So there were all these diseases that silkworms in China did not get, or at least they had figured out workarounds.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you try it in a new world with new microorganisms and your silkworms get sick.
Right.
Silkworms.
Phineas Powers, he folded in year two.
Phineas.
Care and feeding of the silkworms, unspooling of the cocoons, and milling of the thread is highly labor-intensive work, says Robert.
I feel like we already covered this.
Yes, but was considered to be women's work. And then he says to us, see recent discussion in the Memex episode. He's referring to instances where we have talked about women's work in derisive scare quotes.
And how, well, and how it stigmatized different industries. And then the second they were, that turned around for market reasons, it suddenly seemed respectable.
And if you think about the silk industry in China dating back thousands of years, however it is that the people of China are, whatever the labor division is in unspooling cocoons, they worked that out culturally many, many years before.
I've been to a silk farm in Beijing, which seemed to be, I think it was like an indoor kind of underground operation. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
That doesn't seem like it's good for the mulberries.
Yeah, the dark mulberries.
You got to have grow lights or something. But I feel like it was a lot of women doing the reeling.
Right. Well, the women and children in 1830s America evidently were not so interested in all the labor required to reap a few pounds of spun fiber. This, among other problems, led to more interest in the trees than the worms. And here we get to the meat of the story. And now, the rest of the story.
Well, what's interesting about the trees if you don't get silk out of them, Robert?
Well, a failed sericulturalist from Massachusetts named Samuel Whitmarsh was one of those who figured out he could make more money selling the trees than manufacturing the silk, because the craze was sweeping the nation.
So it is like Amway.
Yeah. He promised farmers riches in the silk industry if they planted a faster-growing white mulberry variety called Morus multicaulis. The trees became a hot commodity, and farmers would resell saplings they'd just bought at many X profits. The price for 100 young trees increased from $3 in 1834 to $500 a few years later.
But this is all going to collapse if nobody can actually make a profit on the silk,
well,
right?
Ken, don't get ahead of yourself.
I'm excited. I'm feeling the narrative propulsion of Robert's memo.
Soon, the trees were worth too much to be used for silk culture. At the dizzying heights of the craze, one tree brought more than $100 at auction. And that's
an 1820 whatever dollar.
Yeah. Now he credits that to an article in the Los Angeles Times, which I highly recommend. Whitmarsh was accused of selling regular Morus alba seeds for multicaulis prices. His defense became irrelevant when the bubble finally popped in 1839 and his stock became worthless.
The mulberry bubble.
Across the country, the phrase "just another multicaulis" became a popular phrase used to deride get-rich schemes.
Wait, really?
Yeah. So that's just another multicaulis.
That's how you would use it in a sentence?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. So what would it be like Bitcoin today?
Yeah, just another Bitcoin. That's right. Mm-hmm. And when I told this story to my sister yesterday, she looked at her friend Kenna and they said, Bitcoin. So
just another multicaulis.
Yeah, just another multicaulis.
That's what I think about it.
Many mulberry trees died in the harsh winters or blights of the late 1830s and early 1840s, and the less hardy multicaulis variety went extinct in short order. But the progeny of the alba survivors thrived and spread. So these are some hybrids. Today, white mulberries are found in abundance in every state of the Union, except for Nevada and Alaska. But I don't think here in Seattle. So we'll have to do more research on that.
I don't see them.
After last gasps in Utah and California was finally done by the 1929 stock market crash. So there continued to be interest in California, in like, you know, Pioneer Day California, that maybe that could be the place that America could develop a silk industry.
It's always just around the corner, just around the river bend.
But in the 1930s, we started developing synthetic fibers, you know, the early days of rayon, and rayon made the American silk industry irrelevant.
There's still a silk industry, but I guess it's a import luxury good, not a...
Yeah, that's right. The North American red mulberry is also not as hardy. The proliferation of the Asian white mulberry and its tendency to hybridize, combined with general deforestation, are making pure red mulberries rare. In Canada, Morus rubra is today classified as an endangered species.
Really? Wait, so And that's the one that was native.
That's our native one, yeah.
Well, maybe we should send it to China.
Hey, there you go. Yeah, take that, China. And a couple of other interesting factoids. And I wrote my brother about this because my brother was a cherry orchardist for many decades. Robert says that mulberries are today sometimes planted in cherry orchards as decoy trees because birds prefer, well, the birds go eat the mulberries and leave the cherries alone.
Mm.
Yeah, what do you know about them apples? So now, fully an hour into this episode, I'm going to have to condense Robert's extensive notes on the mulberry in Shakespeare.
Oh yeah, wait.
Yeah.
He was going to call this Shakespeare's mulberry. In what sense is this related to the works of the bard, John?
Well, Shakespeare retells Ovid, the tragedy of Pyramus and Thisbe.
Oh, right. It's in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Pyramus and Thisbe in Midsummer Night's Dream. And
is there a mulberry tree in that?
Well, in Ovid's version, it is that is the origin story of the mulberry. Because, as you know, Ovid likes to, it's like Just So Stories.
Somebody's going to turn into a flower.
Yeah, instead of the rhinoceros getting his scales by rubbing himself, to get the itching powder out. In this case, Pyramus is, his dead body is lain by a white mulberry, his blood stains the fruit, and the gods, swayed by Thisbe, forever change the color of the mulberry fruits to honor their forbidden love.
Ah, I see.
So it's, reading the book, you realize that almost everyone in Ovid either gets raped and turned into a bull or escapes rape by turning into a tree.
Yes, it's like this flower came from a nymph being chased by a horny god.
That's right.
Whereas this other flower came from a different nymph being chased by a horny god.
By a different horny god, right. And it's usually the horny god's wife that turns the nymph into a tree.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes she's mad.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost always Juno. Anyway, so Shakespeare, legendarily, planted a mulberry in his own garden in Stratford-upon-Avon.
Avon.
Avon.
Stratford upon Yvonne DiCarlo.
And so now I'm deeply paraphrasing Robert. But after Shakespeare died, and this is during the period when James I was bringing mulberry saplings into Britain.
Oh, right, yeah.
Before, he then sort of exported it to the United States.
Shakespeare always loved the new fad.
He really did. And he loved James I. The house where Shakespeare planted this mulberry was inherited, inherited / sold to the Reverend Francis Gastrell. And even then in the 1750s, Shakespeare's old house became a kind of place where tourists would go, kind of like Kurt Cobain's house here in Seattle. And Courtney Love tore down Kurt Cobain's suicide garage.
Right.
And similarly motivated, Reverend Francis Gastrell ended up chopping down the mulberry tree.
Because it was attracting tourists.
Because people were coming and taking cuttings from Shakespeare's mulberry tree.
Well, he cut it down?
So he cut it down.
A spiteful guy.
And that infuriated the residents of Stratford-upon-Avon.
Rightly so. Did they run him out of town on a rail?
They ended up running him out of town. But what happened was the wood from the chopped down Shakespeare's mulberry tree was spotted by Thomas Sharp. And that's Sharp with an E at the end, or Sharpie.
I'm sure he said Sharpie.
Who was a local entrepreneur. He took the wood and started making little signs of the true cross out of it, except they were little talismans of, like, this comes from Shakespeare's mulberry tree.
I was reading this old 80s horror magazine from Warren the other night, and one of the ads in it was for actual vials of sand from Dracula's castle.
Wow.
For $17 in 1980, you could get a vial of sand that they claimed came from the exact Romanian castle where where Count Bram Stoker's Dracula lived somehow. And I really wonder...
sandy.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of wonder. And the idea is, you know, that this is the same kind of Transylvanian dirt that he would have had in his own casket. But I don't know. The historical provenance seemed a little dicey. I feel like you could just get dirt from anywhere in Romania and say it was from Dracula's castle.
Well, that's what happened with Shakespeare's mulberry tree. Oh. Like Shards of the True Cross, way more wood items were produced that claimed to be from Shakespeare's mulberry tree than could possibly have come from a single mulberry tree.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So, they're not making any more of that. It's like real estate.
Gastrell or Gastrell.
Yvonne.
Was super frustrated and mad at the residents of Stratford upon Avon, and retaliated by tearing down Shakespeare's house.
Whoa.
And that's why we have no Shakespeare's house to this day.
It's true. Today you can go to Anne Hathaway's house.
Yes.
And the garden's lovely.
Yes.
But all the Shakespeare stuff is a recreation. It's because of this guy.
You can even sit on the bench outside of Kurt Cobain's old house, which is now, I think, just owned by some Amazon millionaire.
Well, it's a park next door. He can't keep people out of a park. He could try.
To this day, there are many, many trees which are thought to be, or which claim to be, scions of Shakespeare's original mulberry.
Because of all the cuttings people were taking.
Taken from the cuttings and propagated, including one such tree in Central Park.
Hmm.
But in 2006, it was determined that that tree was only 80 years old. So it cannot be one of Shakespeare's mulberries. And I have some doubts about
it. I feel like that if it really, that tree is from the 1920s, then that must have been a story of recent vintage. That, yeah. This is probably one of Shakespeare's trees.
I mean, it had
That's
two,
a 1950s story.
A 1950s story, right. And there have been excavations recently, and this is again from Robert, excavations at New Place there in Stratford-upon-Avon, Shakespeare's home. Which have lent credence to the theories that Shakespeare was a pot smoker.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
What do you think they found? Like pot. Glassware?
Yeah, they found a broken graphics bong and a prototype and like seven little baggies.
That's crazy.
Full of some really purple buds.
I knew it.
Hairy purple buds.
I knew it. Because sometimes I read some of those sonnets and I'm like, this guy's tripping.
Dude, this guy's so
I want to smoke what this guy is smoking.
Right on, bro.
Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May.
So, in conclusion, in Robert's own words, I have tasted mulberries from trees throughout my neighborhood, across the country, and on three continents.
Whoa, we kind of have some unusual mulberry expertise here.
Robert is not new to mulberries.
Mulberry taster Robert Chaos.
And you know, mulberry trees take between 5 and 8 years to grow to the size that a silkworm would enjoy its tender leaves. So it's not a thing where you just throw a mulberry in the ground and you got silkworms going. I mean, this is part of the way that it could be such a boom on trees. Because it wasn't such a quick turnaround that you could say, hey, I bought those trees last year and I'm not a millionaire. There was always that kind of, oh, it takes a little while. Anyway, back to Robert. The best tasting mulberries.
Here we go.
Come from the backyard in the house where I grew up. My mom makes a killer mulberry pie.
Wow, it's like he traveled all around the world to three continents. And it turns out
the mulberry he was searching for was right in his own backyard.
Isn't that so often the case, though?
I mean, where are the mulberries that you and I are searching for? We never thought to look.
And that concludes Mulberry Mania, entry 815.2S0523, certificate number 26780, in the omnibus. Do we feel bad about letting Robert do all the heavy lifting here, doing all the hard work?
No, I think it went pretty well. I mean, I filled in some of the missing pieces in Robert's story.
We certainly couldn't have testified as to, you know, his mom's mulberry pie recipe. We don't have access to that.
We still don't know whether that's true or not. But Robert, you know, Robert is no like mulberry come lately. And, you know, all of the way, all of the like, here we go round the mulberry bush,
To think that I saw it on Mulberry Street.
Mulberry Street and all the Mulberry Streets in towns across the United States all date from this period. Pop Goes the Weasel. Their first recorded instances are always in 1830 or
There's a ton of mulberry in the culture relative to how much of it you actually eat, which is zero.
Right. And that's all those are all sort of echoes through, speaking of Ovid, they're all echoes through the sands of time.
I kind of enjoyed figuring out why you hear so much about mulberries, but you never actually eat them.
Yeah.
Oh. It's all silkworms all the way down.
Silkworms all the way down.
If you would like to suggest a topic of an omnibus show, that's available at the Washing Bear level of support at patreon.com/omnibusproject. If you enjoy the show and your budget allows, check out that site and pick the donation level that's right for you. You can also find us on social media at Omnibus Project. I'm at Ken Jennings. You can find John on a separate Patreon site. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com with your own mulberry pie recipes or silk reeling tips. You can send us physical items to our P.O. Box at Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Today, I just opened this book from a listener named Alan, who sent us an early copy of this children's book he just wrote called Maybe and the Gravy. It's about a young girl who doesn't like gravy.
How can you not like gravy? Unless she's a vegetarian.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. They don't get into that.
But even then, you could have, like, vegetarian gravy.
It turns into more... gravy seems to be chosen because it rhymes with maybe. It turns into more of a book about how she learns to try new things and even embrace change when a friend of hers moves away. Spoilers.
Mm, that's nice.
Thank you for sending us the book, Alan. It looks like it's due out soon. We also, you're going to be very excited about this, John. You got a note from...
What? This says...
The Kentucky Colonels in Louisville.
What?
Louisville.
What? What, what, what?
If your note is anything like mine, well, first of all, you'll get a welcome colonel.
This is addressed
package
to Colonel John Roderick. Was yours addressed to Colonel Ken Jennings?
That's true. It comes with this little certificate with a gold stamp telling me that I now hold the highest civilian honor the governor of the Commonwealth of Kentucky can bestow, the title of Kentucky colonel.
No, really, really, really?
And there's a membership card.
What? Oh, no. Are you kidding me? Wow. Oh, I'm so excited.
It appears to be a nonprofit. The executive director, Colonel Sherry Crose, notes that they do good work supporting worthy Kentucky organizations.
Oh, this bond, this paper bond, has these little like rivets on the edges.
Oh, you're right.
It's so fantastic.
Well, they didn't spare any expense.
And it's got a membership card.
But it looks like the idea is that you... you choose at which level you would like to support.
Be a Kentucky colonel?
We've been Patreoned by the state of Kentucky.
Wow. Wow. You know, I've been seeking out being a Kentucky colonel for many, many years.
And it turns out all you had to do was write a check.
Well, we didn't write a check.
Well, we got signed up, but that's how they get you, I think.
Oh, I see. I see.
And if you give more than $100 this year to the Kentucky Colonels Good Works Program, your name will feature in the annual Colonels of Distinction Contributors Report.
Now, I don't know if you're going to do this, but I definitely am.
We love the CODCR, don't we, folks?
Yes, we do.
I feel like I'm going to donate because they sent me all this stuff. Are you going to buy merch? There's a Kentucky Colonels Nike hat.
No kidding.
There's a Kentucky Colonels Campfire coffee mug.
I mean, I'm not even embarrassed how much this kind of thing just delights me to no end. And maybe I should be embarrassed. Maybe I should be one of those people that doesn't care about things in the material world and just sits on a toadstool and enjoys the smell of the fresh pines.
It's not clear whether somebody signed us up or if the organization itself somehow became aware of your love for the Kentucky Colonels.
Became sentient itself. Do I want? I mean, what you get here? You can get a like a license plate for your front your front license plate that says Honorable Order of the Kentucky Colonels, I think that might be misunderstood out here. You know what I mean? It could be confusing.
Yeah, Kentucky has had many colonels in the United States Army.
Yes.
But it
yes.
probably had some colonels in some other armies over
so.
The years.
I believe so. You can get a challenge coin. You can get a 10-carat gold ring only costs $1,250. You'd have to really be into it there.
Does it cheapen the honor for you at all now knowing that really at any point you could have just got this catalog in the mail and it's not actually an elite group of anything?
No, I don't believe that's true. I don't think you get this catalog. I think you have to probably, you have to add your number, right? You've got your certificate number right here. I mean, I don't want to tell people my number because they could go get
Governor
Merch in my name.
Governor Andy Beshear thanks us for stepping up to serve the Commonwealth once again.
So there's a list of 2020 grantees, which we're not on, but I bet we're on the 2021 list.
Well, if we make a donation, we will be. It's interesting that the governor of Beshear, through a bizarre series of political shenanigans, is currently a Democrat. So it's actually...
hip, hip, hooray.
It's actually Governor Beshear welcoming us to the Kentucky Colonels.
That's nice.
Probably hasn't happened a lot in the last 50 years.
I mean, that makes the honor feel more... palatable.
So you are
right?
going to get the license plates around.
Well, there's a lapel pin, which is very cool that I might put on my King Neptune outfit. So how do you feel about it? I mean, I'm thrilled.
I'm still bewildered. I wish we had found out who in the state of Kentucky had decided to enroll us so we could thank them and find out more about that process.
I mean, the only thing that kind of diminishes this honor is that you received it too. But I suppose, you know,
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
But in reverse,
I think, you know, you probably have at least as much cause to be benighted a Kentucky colonel. Maybe not benighted.
I've been to Kentucky.
Right.
I've been to Kentucky a couple times.
But you've brought joy to the people of Kentucky.
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
Perhaps also some heartbreak. We don't know. Hard to measure.
Think about all the people that have watched you on television and dreamt of your sweet kisses who will go unkissed.
But how many of them were rooting for someone else? Maybe Kentucky is a hotbed of James Holzhauer fans. Maybe there's a little place called Holzhauer Holler where people hate me. We don't know.
Almost certainly.
If you are responsible for our joining the Kentucky Colonels, first, thank you. Second, please let us know. Take credit for your achievement. Email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can also find your fellow listeners in this era or presumably any other by looking for the Futurelings on Facebook or maybe Discord. There's a subreddit, I think. It's a good time.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past when the state of Kentucky still existed because the United States of America still existed, we have no idea how long this bankrupt civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.